This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Thursday, May 18th, 2023. I'm Jeff O'Neill. And as always, or as most of the time, with Rebecca Shinsky. Rebecca was out last week. I've got some beautiful follow-up to you. You missed a couple of stunners, but you're going to get some follow-up this week, Rebecca, about stuff.
I really did.
Let's see.
Wonderful.
Anything else interesting coming up? Oh, for the Patreon folks or the people on the fence about Patreon, right after this, Rebecca and I are recording next week's members-only post or episode that goes up on Patreon. Patreon.com/BookRiotPodcast will be the link in the show notes. And it's our 10 years of doing this, Rebecca. 10 years of podcasting.
It was your 11-year
work anniversary this month as well. I don't know if you actually started May 1st in our employee back end. It said May 1st, but I kind of, I'm not sure if it was actually May 1st or in the middle or where.
It was, I don't remember either. I think May 1st of 2012
there
was when I officially became full-time. But I was part-time since the very beginning. So it's kind of a workiversary, but kind of not.
But yeah, May of 2013 with an asterisk, 11 and is then when we some. Started the podcast. We got to be us style. We haven't prepped for that episode, except that I have some stuff I'm going to throw at you about, the 10 years of podcasting.
Perfect.
And, Kelly was on last week, and she was great, by the way, for all of you that maybe, because I am like
Kelly's
this too.
Wonderful.
Where if my normal people aren't on my shows, sometimes I'm less likely to hit the play button. Kelly was really good. And it was a fun episode to do in the first half. And then she came on. We continued to talk in a broader specific way about the book banning and censorship stuff. And she knows as much, I dare say, of anyone. Honestly, I'm not sure. Maybe there's someone somewhere.
I think that's right.
We talked about specific legislation and general terms, and go listen to it. I would encourage you. You can mute me for that episode and just listen to Kelly at the end. Really good stuff there. But I've got some follow-up from the weirdness. I think the name of that episode is People Have Lost Their Minds, and we got to continue because, people don't gain them right away.
Yes.
You just don't shove them back in.
They don't. It's hard to pick up the pieces and put them back together if you've just fully lost it already. I lost my mind a little bit just catching up on some of this news in our company Slack and then knowing for sure that you and Kelly would have talked about it. And I checked the agenda and
they
the episode. I was like, yep, they got it. But wow, like the wildest things always happen when I'm on vacation. Like, I'm still mad that the story about the quote unquote new Harper Lee novel happened while I was on vacation.
I remember where I was for that. I was in our old Brooklyn office, and I was sitting next to Jen Northington. Like, we were both in there working that day, and we were like, wait, is this happening? The whole thing. It was incredible.
Yeah, I was I was traveling somewhere for work, and I remember being on Amtrak and listening to you and Amanda Nelson talking about it, being like, I cannot believe that I am not getting to talk about this right now. This is just truly bonkers. But the bonkers was more of a fun flavor.
Yeah, it was fun. So we're going to follow up about a couple of things after the break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi. If you like pretty things, like I like pretty things, I got something for you. The stunning sequel to the worldwide phenomenon Children of Blood and Bone is now available in a deluxe paperback edition with gorgeous spray-painted and stenciled edges and an exclusive excerpt of the earth-shaking Children of Anguish and Anarchy. Now, this is a series for you if you like action, you like world building, you like mythology retellings, lore retellings, specifically of a West African variety, has all that and more. It was also an instant number one New York Times bestseller, a Good Morning America book club pick, and now both Children of Bone and Children of Virtue and Vengeance are available in these deluxe editions. They're pretty, they're gorgeous. The finale to the series is coming June 25th this year, so you can get the pretty editions of the first two books and be ready for the last book. You see what I'm saying? So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social-climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must-read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at leighbardugothefamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
The first thing is, this news broke about 2 hours after Kelly and I finished recording about the secret nonfiction title 4C from Flatiron, and we did some speculation, and we had even heard some rumors that I think we put on that show that it was going to be BTS, that book, that people thought were going to be, it was Taylor Swift, so just put a B on it, and that's what you got. Instead of TS, you got BTS. From Flatiron, so that's what it was. People are still emailing with guesses. And also, I'll say this, I love that for you that are emailing, because you are not enough online to know that this has happened. That's not satirical. I wish I was with you. That's really good.
You have a healthy relationship to the internet.
But, so it's going to sell. I think Kelly said, I'm not sure why we don't get more. Kelly is also a connoisseur of the celebrity memoir, and not in an ironical way. I mean, in a very serious, this is real talk. And we talked about that some too. And it feels like there is more opportunity for big memoir releases with massive print runs for international celebrity. And, you know, there's all kinds of K-pop groups I know that could benefit and would sell copies. I'm not even sure who else is out there. But it was notable that the whole internet assumed it was Taylor Swift, and that's some Eurocentric white people stuff, I think. Where I think globally BTS is a bigger deal than Taylor Swift. I don't know. I don't know what my Q rating is on that, but that's my sense.
Yes. And they're such a big deal that I really have a hard time wrapping my head around it. Like, just around the size of a truly global sensation like that, that comes out of a part of the world that is much more populated than, you know, Western Europe and the United States, with a bunch of white people who think that everything is about us. I think it's one of the, it seems obvious in hindsight of of course. But I just consistently can't get my head really around how just truly
and
how
that
big
starts
that phenomenon
to,
is.
The Tumblr start to click into place. We were talking about the $45 price. So it's like a, it's like a token, a souvenir almost of fandom in a way. Like Kelly brought up the Paul McCartney lyrics book. I was like, I thought that was a great comp, right? A Taylor Swift memoir will sell at some point. She will do it, though you could say her music is the ongoing memoir. I hope you're taking cover, John Mayer, from, I guess, what's coming out pretty soon of things that I've heard. I don't know. I don't know things, but I hear things, Rebecca. I don't really understand them, but I do hear them. And so that's the kind of thing where it's like, it would be a weird moment. And I don't know in the BTS timeline where they are. Are they launching a new album? Are they going on tour? I haven't followed any of that. So it could be being a little unfair to try to do a particular Taylor Swift hook to say why this doesn't make sense. But there's something about the flavor of it that this makes more sense to me. I'm sure Taylor Swift could, or Beyonce or some of the other names we kicked out, could put together a title or what this is going to look like. I think there's something to the group element versus the single person thing that matters, right? We don't think of it as a group memoir. I don't know how that would even work, though. I think that would be fascinating. Yeah. But this is going to be kind of a coffee table fan book. And I mean that in all seriousness and openness. Like, that's an awesome thing. Yeah. I hope it sells a billion copies.
And totally. At that price point, I would guess it will probably also have like some beautiful, you know, full page, right, full color inserts of photos of them. This is like kind of a Pillars of the Garth flavored product.
And you do one now, you can move another one in 5 years.
Even
right?
Garth, like, probably,
you know, you do them
inspires,
in stages, they'll be primed to do another one.
Right. Yeah. Because I think you're onto something with the idea that Taylor Swift's music sort of is the, at least right now, is the memoir. Like, it's not the whole story, but it's very personal, very confessional.
Yes.
And very thinly veiled. You know, most of the time we can pin particular songs to particular people, or at least to particular rumors about Taylor Swift. And she will say things like, you know, the album Midnights, every song is about like a particular, one particular night or one particular late night epiphany or something like that, that I would, my money is on a late career or like retirement time of life memoir from Taylor Swift, the kind of thing that I wish Stevie Nicks would write now. Yeah. You know, maybe in 30 years we get like the full Taylor Swift story about the things that were happening when she was on tour and like really who that song was about and all those kinds of things. But she's doing it all right now in the songs, in these big arena tours that, you know, people are like selling their firstborn to get tickets to. It looks like it's going super well. And if you are putting that much of yourself into the music, like, why redirect it into a book at this point is also an interesting question, I think. But I mean, I'll be ready for it when Taylor Swift wants to tell all. I love a celebrity memoir, not quite as much as Kelly does, but Kelly is my top of the funnel. If she says the celebrity or musician memoir is really good.
I still didn't get a good answer in even reading some of the press releases from Flatiron and, you know, coverage elsewhere of why we're so close. And I think Flatiron's hand was forced here to reveal this. It doesn't feel like they were going to reveal it till closer to pub date, and which is in July, which I don't really understand. You know, this is this is where I'm still far from the publishing industry and the comings and goings. Everyone has their reasons. I'm sure there is some reason to do it this way. I don't understand what it is, because you want to build the hype, you want to get those pre-orders up, you want to make sure you have enough copies on hand. It seems like there's a lot of uncertainty about how big of a deal this would be. And I don't see the upside of not saying that this is a BTS title 6 months ago, frankly. But I don't get that. If anyone knows, podcast@bookriot.com.
Right. Really interesting. This automatically goes to the top of my list of guesses about books that booksellers will have trouble keeping in stock at the holidays.
Yeah, you can see it would make sense for a hot seller like this that you want to get... it's kind of like having the Wednesday night release for a Marvel movie. You clear the mechanism of like the real hardcore people, so you have time for the more casual people to come on board, or people giving it as a gift a little bit later. But I don't know why this isn't in the docket yet. Because like the Britney Spears thing or the Prince Harry thing, we knew those were coming well ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh yeah.
It's fascinating. I'm sure
it's really interesting.
Maybe there's maybe the fandom is so intense. There's leaks and rumors and people trying to get a copy and pirating. Like you could tell me all sorts of things. We may be out of scale with my normal like what's it called, street date or lay down date kind of mathematics or tradecraft to go into this. But if anyone knows or has a link, podcast@bookriot.com. I'd love to know what the second order logistics of something with this huge of a fandom and following brings to bear on the whole situation. Speaking of second order effects of fandoms. So we talked last week about, and we don't know who this person is, so I just have to keep using their pseudonym, which is, I think, just how they like it. You can't even
so
euphemize it because
be
it's
this.
Still
this
euphemized already. But
we'll,
you can't even say Big D. That doesn't help you. That's worse somehow than Bigolus Diggolus. Tweeting about Amal El-Muhtar and Max Gladstone's 2019 novella, This Is How You Lose the Time War, that became a phenomenon in the course of a week, became the third best-selling book on Amazon basically overnight, as far as I can tell, and showed up at number 6 mm-hmm. on the New York Times bestsellers list. And this, so they're selling a lot of copies. But the thing that's happening now is, A, the think pieces about this are insufferable, what this means for marketing.
Yes.
And I even saw things like, this isn't being struck by lightning because it's the convergence of two fandoms, because people are like this book and they like this. Like, there's lots of fandoms that have converged. I think you can't read too much of this into it. You can't read too much into this. It's like finding $1,000 on the sidewalk. It's great. People love this, but I don't see there's any lesson yes. to learn here, Rebecca. There's nothing to learn. Does your sense of this is the same or is it different?
I don't think there is. Yeah, I think this is, if you're the author of this book or the publisher of it and you wake up and you see that this has happened, your first thought should not be, how can I recreate yeah. this for my next book or all of my other authors? It's right. thank you to the gods of the internet. This happens to like 4 people for their whatever the product is each year, and it is sheer nope. luck. You can't sign up for it. You can't ask for it. You can't predict it. You'd be silly to hope for it because you mm-hmm. are basically guaranteed to be disappointed. This is a gift from the gods of the internet. There is nothing to learn here. Like, I could imagine, I think the worst possible version of trying to learn something from this would be like trying to develop some tool where you identify yeah. other Twitter users whose profiles are yeah. in some way similar to this one, and then be like, these are the things that made this catch on. And maybe like when we have, you know, finally freed ourselves from Twitter and we're 20 years down the line, someone will be able to look back at a bunch of these and identify patterns, you know, looking back like retrospectively. I also kind of doubt that. I think this is serendipity of the highest order, and that even Bigolus Diggolus is probably deeply surprised yeah. about what happened here. Maybe more surprised than anyone.
His following, or the avatar, is a male presenting anime figure, and I'm going by the euphemism. I'm just going to throw some male pronouns on this. Just, I'm guessing here. I could be wrong. If anyone knows, you can tell me. His following count has gone from, when I first saw this tweet, so I was already later in it, it was like 12-ish thousand, right? 12-ish thousand followers. You have any mm-hmm. guess what it is now? Yeah, you haven't been on Twitter in a long time. This is unfair. 48,000. So 36,000 new followers in a week. That, again, that doesn't seem like a lot, but you're quadrupling it. And remember, Twitter is a declining asset right now. Like, that's a lot of people in 1 week.
This would make me... Yeah. This would make me want to crawl into a hole if I were Bigolus Diggolus. Like, you're sharing a book that you love to, you know, some mm-hmm. what you expect to be some small percentage of your 12,000 followers because of the algorithm, and then you quadruple your followers like basically overnight, and now people are writing stories about you. I think I would be just like, okay, it's a ridiculous pseudonym, but it's a pseudonym. This person's real name is not on this Twitter yep. account, and I assume that there are reasons for this, whatever they may be. And so I think I'm in panic mode. I don't even know. I probably would have locked the account and been like, bye. Please don't figure
Luckily,
out who I am.
He's already clothed himself in a shield of avatar and pseudonym, so I'm not sure that people are going to go doxing. They're not going to go a doxing, but you could imagine different things. I've read a lot about this, so a couple things I want to bring up. One is, I saw this is a side effect of looking at Twitter a little bit now and again, trying not to go down the rabbit hole. But publisher people working in publishing talking about coming out of sales meetings where they talk about Bigolus Diggolus and this phenomenon, and I'm like, there's nothing to learn here. There's, if anything to be learned, is the wrong lesson. So like, it's a thing. It's out there in the world of people staring at this. I mean, like, is there anything we can do? The second, so that's one. I haven't read anything that it compels me to see there's anything that this is how you should be marketing, and all the professionals want to have a take. I think the humility needed to say, boy, I don't know, is pretty tough. And I think this is one of those. But I'm glad to see mm-hmm. that Amal El-Muhtar signed a deal for 4 new books last week. Which is fantastic.
Yes.
Now, sometimes these turn into careers. This is the kind of thing you become a phenomenon and turn into a career. I guess it's a good time to plug the most recent edition of First Edition that just came out, in which I talked to Colette Hosseini about the phenomenon. Mm. I called it the bookography of the kite runner. It came out 20 years ago. He was very kind to come on and talk to me for 45 minutes or so. It's in the episode now. It's in the feed now. And his understanding was, you know, the hardcover didn't really sell. It did okay, but it was no big thing. He was doing it. There, a couple of nuggets to tease that. He did a reading. I think I told you this story, Rebecca, where he was on tour for the hardback, and he went to a reading mm-hmm. at some bookstore, and there were 3 people in the audience, and one of them was using a walker. And in the middle of the reading, the person with a walker stood up to leave. Mm-hmm. So that's not easy for a person with a walker mm-hmm. to get up and leave. They really won't have to leave there. And then when the paperback comes out, and he talks a little bit about what his best understanding of what happened was, it became a phenomenon. And his agent and everyone saying, this doesn't happen. Like, do you realize? He's like, yeah, I do get this. It's mm-hmm. But he did make a career out of it. Thousand Splendid Suns sold like gangbusters. And The Mountain's mm-hmm. Echoes have sold. That book, it's been 10 years since he had anything out. I didn't ask him about that because he was gracious enough to come on. I wasn't trying to put his feet to the fire. He did say a little bit something like, he wrote The Kite Runner in like 18 months while working a full-time job as a doctor. He's like, that seems incredibly fast to me now, given what I know now. So he's talking a little bit about, you know, the creative process or where he mm-hmm. is right now. But these things happen. You can't make Kite Runners. You can't make Da Vinci Codes. You cannot do it. You make enough books, and every now and again, you get something like this.
You can't.
That's all there is to it.
Yeah, the lesson to learn here is just a reification of every book is a lottery ticket. And, you know, you can't mm-hmm. win if you don't play. So some of them are going to win. Most of them are going to lose. Some of them are going to win. The only thing you could have done to engineer this is travel back in time
right.
and know magically that this Twitter user on this day was going to hit the algorithm in a particular way, that if they recommended your book, it was going to blow up. And you can't time travel back. There's nothing to do here. I think that I think you're right here that the author is set up to potentially make the kind of career out of mm-hmm. it, like you're talking about Hosseini and some other authors being able to build on. You can build on the lightning in a bottle if you can then continue to deliver a good product. Because what this really hinges on is not just that someone recommended a book, but that all right. these people who have made this book a bestseller, now they have to like it. And it sounds to me, I think there was kind of a cult following around this mm-hmm. title. I remember hearing a lot of folks talk about really liking yes. it, but it was book nerds. It was people who, capital B, capital N, book nerds, loved This Is How You Lose the Time War. And if it can break out from there and reach a bunch of new people, which it has, and it's hit the bestseller list again, if it delivers to them, and I think there's a good chance it will because of the reputation this title has, if that author can continue to deliver, then you can build your career on it. If you have something that is just splashy and a bunch of people like it, but it doesn't yeah. stand up once they've read it, they're not going to keep coming back for the future ones. So I think it's wise for the publisher here to invest in this author and, you know, follow it up with these book deals. I do think this book is going to deliver on what most of the folks who bought it based yeah. on Bigelus Dickelus's recommendation are looking for. It could be a thing, but if you're an author or a publisher and the thing you're spending your time doing is trying to figure out how you can locate a Bigelus Dickelus type figure on Twitter and get your book to them and profit.
That's not going to happen.
I don't think that's the best use of time. It's not going to happen. Yep. This is a gift from the internet, and to treat it like anything that could have been planned or predicted or controlled is to fundamentally misunderstand how the internet and how these algorithms
there might be
especially
a
work.
A couple of the edges of this that are interesting to me is it's literary romantic sci-fi, this title. You can see why it might mm-hmm. be underread. Mm-hmm. Now, it has a following, and I think that's part of it. Like, once this tweet happened and it had a momentum, but then a lot of people are chiming in, I love that book. I don't know why more people aren't talking about it. So it had a bit of it had some oxygen, but I also think there's something that maybe that kind of a title that's on multi-generic coming from a different way, maybe. But again, it had a bunch of Amazon reviews. I read this book a long time ago. I liked it. I know a lot of other people did. It wasn't obscure, like you said, in a book nerd kind of a way. I don't know. The more I stare at this, I feel like I feel like I get a little tendril in my hand of something to hold on to, and then it just slips away again as I think about it more and more. So.
Well, yeah, that the multi-genre, especially those three, the intersection of those three genres, this is pretty similar to some of the titles that have gone big.
And big feelings, like this is like break your heart that, stuff, like, and you know, that's related to something.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. But even then, if you're trying to learn something from it, like if you're sitting down today to be like, I guess I'll write a book that is in the Venn diagram of these genres and that has big feelings, because that's what the kids on TikTok want. You might get a book deal from it because publishers are paying attention today to the trends that are happening today. But by the time the book comes out, it's not very likely that those will still be the trends. Like, this is the problem, I think, that social media and any phenomenon like this presents for publishers is it has already been the phenomenon by the time you start chasing it. And by the time another book comes out that you've purchased based on this today phenomenon, something else will be hot by the time that book comes out. So I think just keep buying lottery tickets, keep publishing good books that you reasonably believe can find an audience, with the knowledge that most of them won't and some of them will.
Not Bigelow Thickless gets a little bit of his I can't use any analogy or metaphor because they all sound extremely dirty, but also get a little a piece of the action. Not that this works, but there's I'm at a loss for a metaphor or analogy, which, as you know, for me is very, very rare. Really tells you the magnitude of the event here. But Bigelow's Dickless, God, every time I just stop. I'm not a professional today.
I'm so delighted. I'm so glad there's follow-up.
That account's particular kink, I'm using this in the broadest term, was basically a fan account for Trigun, which is a manga by Yashiro Naitao. And it's a Western anime. I know nothing about it except what I've read in blurbs. And it was announced, let's see, 2 days ago, that there's going to be a new deluxe hardcover edition of Trigun.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't mention this phenomenon in the text of the press release, but it cannot be a coincidence. It can't be. I just don't believe it.
That would be hard to believe. I don't know. Right now, I think we've had 10 good years of this, and maybe we should retire because I'm never going to be
10 years and out
on this podcast that I am.
It's like
right
Quentin
now.
Tarantino, 10 movies and you're out. For us, it's 10 years and we're done.
Yeah, that's how they do it, right?
So turning these into, you know, seeing if there's a little more demand for that title, I guess now I know about it. I guess I'm not more likely to pick it up. Mm-hmm. 17 million people saw his original tweet about this, how you lose the time war. This,
it's just some crazy really stuff. Mind-blowing.
All right, let's do another sponsor break. And we've got some news, but I've got one other thing I want to throw at you that I didn't prepare you for at all. Congratulations to you.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult / crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by WW Norton & Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Gillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Gillian Linden. And thanks again to W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode.
I don't know how seriously to take all the LLM AI writing tool things. There's one going around today that I started watching the video on Twitter. It's from a company called PseudoWrite. And the founder of this company posted a 15-minute long tutorial of how to use PseudoWrite to write your novel. And it's going pretty big, mostly in whatever the following. I'm looking at people saying, we don't want this, this is terrible, which is fine and to be expected. I'm not even sure that it's wrong. But the takes aren't that interesting. They're fairly predictable. I watched the whole thing this morning, Rebecca, and I don't know why I did, but
okay.
It's really interesting. I'll link it in the show notes. It says, the company says, and the founder says, it was created in collaboration with hundreds of novelists to present a UI to make a large language model conducive to writing a novel. So I don't think I'd seen one that's really built to be a novel writing interface. You can use ChatGPT, and I haven't looked at all of them, so if there's other ones out there, forgive me. This is the one I've seen that's built for the purpose of writing, creating, generating the language that you use, collaborating with an AI, LLM, to write a full novel. And here are my three takeaways. One, the technology is wild. It just really is, where you give a little synopsis, you say what you want it to be about, it then can present you some characters, you fill out some beats that you want it to have, and you can start generating it. And you can decide if you like that. Do you want it to be more florid or more straightforward or faster paced? There's some things you can do. It's really wild what it can do. But the net effect of it, though, and then you read like the first chapter. So presumably this is as good as it gets, because you're going to put your best foot forward of like, here's the first chapter or the first half of the first chapter. Here's what put out. It's so stultifyingly below average that I'm not even sure what to say about it. Like, if you think this is going to do anything,
okay,
besides flood the market with barely mid novels, did I use that right? Can someone check me? Is there a 14-year-old around? I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. And the gulf between what is writable with an LLM and what is interesting to read is the Grand Canyon right now. And if people who read this chapter think, yes, this is going to disrupt novel writings. Now, this doesn't mean it's not going to get better, and I don't know. But the gulf seems so wide that I don't know how you bridge it, because it is spitting out the most anodyne, boilerplate stuff. And it just is, this is a very impressive tool, but what it makes is nothing I have any interest in reading, and I can't see it cannibalizing or competing with anyone. Maybe if you are doing, I don't even know what, I could imagine if you like to write fan fiction for yourself or something, maybe, like you're just wanting story and beats and familiar names. I think that's unfair to fan fiction writers. I'm just trying to find a case where this seems interesting at all, because it can spit out 300 pages of extremely derivative writing. Now, the punctuation is correct, and it's structurally, it makes sense. Not always, but I'll say that. You could read worse self-published things. You could. It could be better than many self-published things.
Sure.
But I got to tell you. And I do recommend, if you're interested, I'll watch the video to see how, and then watch what comes out. Because I'm in it, I'm watching like, wow, this is, oh my God, is it Doc Brown finding the flux capacitor? This is, and then it spits it out, I'm like, oh, well. Because it's not even bad enough to be interesting. Like, it doesn't even make interesting mistakes. That you're like, oh, I see if you just tweak this up or down. It is, there's something, it feels like there's an uncanny valley that seems unfordable to get across. So that's where I am. And I haven't really spent this much time with it before. And I'm hitting you straight. What do you think? Does that make sense? What do you think?
That's fascinating. Yeah, it does. I mean, the thing that, not just we, but like most people who are paying attention to these AI and LLM models right now are talking about is that they are derivative and they spit out, you know, combinations of things that have already been produced. They can't create and they certainly can't transcend in any way yet. Maybe they will someday, but they don't have original ideas. I think my biggest question is, who is the actual customer or the actual market for this? Because every writer that I've known, and I've known a lot of them, talk about how you're a writer because you have to be, you know, or in that Rilke sense of, if you wake up in the morning and the first thing that you think about is writing and the last thing you think about before you go to bed at the end of the day is writing, you're a writer. And that is as paraphrased by Sister Mary Clarence in Sister Act 2. But like, do writers, people who think of themselves as writers, who have stories and characters living in their brains that they have to, that they feel compelled to spend their one wild and precious life sitting down, putting those stories out into the world in some fashion, putting pen to paper, putting your little fingers on the keyboard. I don't believe that, like, capital W writers want or need this product, because for them, the getting the thing that exists in their brain out into the world is the thing. And just like prompting an AI to create language that is, it sounds like, mediocre at best, isn't likely to scratch that itch. So if writers aren't going to use it, then maybe there is an audience like the one you're talking about, of people who want to generate their own stories about characters that they already like, you know, like, write me a Hunger Games derivative. And if the language could be better, maybe that would be satisfying. Like, if you wanted to read fan fiction that didn't exist yet, but you didn't want to write the fan fiction. But that's like a really, that's a very specific kind of user for a pretty small slice of the pie, I think. I think this currently falls into the realm of, I understand why someone who can create AI technology created a thing like this. Like, it seems like maybe it would meet a need, and maybe you're going to follow that and see what you could develop. I understand pursuing the question. It doesn't sound to me like the answer that they've arrived at here in the form of this product is one that writers are going to want, one that readers who are interested in the craft of language are going to want. And so therefore, like, certainly not something that's threatening to the future of art, as all the think pieces about it are
currently. There are genres in which I am not an expert, especially when it's like category genre, that sometimes the formula is the thing, and that's different than what I want as a reader. So think of the most formulaic genre or subgenre you can think of. Maybe this competes with some of that. I don't know. I don't know. It's been a long time since I read something that was really catering to someone who wants to read 50 of the same things or slight variations of. Maybe it competes with that. I do think, to also quote a writer, though, there is the Anne Lamott of, more people want to have written than want to write. And I think people might see this as, you know, I had this idea for a novel and I just never got around to writing it, because writing is hard and you have to sit there and do it. And it's very difficult. And most of the time, in my experience and the experience of others, it's very uncomfortable and frustrating, and you got to do the thing. It's work. Let's put it that way. It's work. And the dream here of the people that haven't written is, can I skip the work part, right? Is there a way to skip most, if not all, of the work part? And I don't see that that's true right now. Because here's the thing, everyone else is going to have the access to the same tool, right? So, and I've used this phrase before, and I think it matters. I'm looking for special books, and the books people remember are special books. Kind of by its nature at this point, and I do want to put that caveat, I am not an expert in this technology. I don't know what's possible in the future, you know, what we're on the cusp of, you know, I don't know. But by its nature, looking at huge data sets of language and basically trying to figure out the most likely thing, you get the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, well, even just to go back to talking about, like, not necessarily the Bigless Dickless phenomenon, but you were saying, like, you can't engineer a Da Vinci code. You can't engineer any of these big things. Stuff that breaks out that way usually breaks out because it's doing something new or it's doing an old thing in a new way. And that is what AI can't currently do. Like, I'm in the middle of working on an essay about the Station 11 adaptation, and I'm spending a lot of time thinking about the one scene that, like, you and I talked about, everybody who loved the show has talked about, where a character, like, gets up and, like, spontaneously starts rapping a Tribe Called Quest song in this very surprising moment that is, like, one of the most transcendent experiences I've had with any piece of art in any medium. AI can't come up with that idea yet. That still requires a human to be like, what if he did this in this moment? Because that kind of moment hadn't happened anywhere else. Like, you couldn't have plugged in to this machine, write me an episode of a TV series that's about a pandemic and people are sitting around a dining table. Like, I imagine, get very stultified kinds of dialogue. You're not going to get a machine being like, oh, and the thing that should happen here is he should jump up and everyone should be surprised and then he should rap. And, like, I think if or when we see a model, a piece of technology that can generate a creative idea, that's when I will be open to the AI is coming for your novels, AI is coming for the writer's jobs kind of piece. Like, I can see, I've been playing around with ChatGPT enough to know, like, I can see places where AI is coming for elements of work, certainly, or for particular kinds of jobs. I think that's correct and very real, and that we're all going to have to learn how to use it effectively, you know, to different degrees in our different industries, but it cannot create, it can't generate something new. And much of art, if that's what we're looking for in literature, is about something new, is about reading a sentence you've never read before, hearing a story you have not heard before, having someone express an old idea in a new way. And it's that new way part.
Yeah.
That
and I don't know if, and it's interesting to think about my, I had such a strong feeling that I don't think I've ever had before of, like, recognizing the hollowness of what it spit out. Like, it just, now maybe because maybe I'm biased against it, I'm sure that I'm coming in with all my Kahneman and Tversky, like, who knows what my biases are. I mean, it's probably multiple of them intersecting to perform emergent properties. If I had just been given this as a novel with a name on it that looked like a traditional published book, I probably would have the same feeling of hollowness. I would have had the same feeling of, this is totally uninteresting to me. But because I saw what went into it and how formulaic it was, and that it's a very elegant, fast, polished nothing. Just, it's like biting into a donut and there's no taste. It looks like a donut, kind of feels like a donut, but it doesn't taste at all like a donut.
It's like the Soylent. Yeah, it's the Silicon Valley Soylent Green, like, drink this smoothie or take this pill so you don't have to eat lunch. Like,
well, it's kind of the opposite of that, I guess, where it's,
you,
like,
didn't have a meal.
You don't get the nutrients, you get the form and appearance of. And then I had this very strong reaction of, like, maybe it's impossible to do what humans do with language and feeling. Now, I could be wrong about that. And I think I'm that's not what I want. My prior is, I would like not for robots to be able to write Paradise by Toni Morrison. I just would not. I think right now that's not something I'm looking forward to.
Same.
So there's my prior on this. But as far as I can see, I don't know how an AI that I saw working is going to come up with the first line of, they shoot the white girl first. I don't see how. I don't see how you would do that. Right. You'd have to have it turn out so many possibilities and pick from them that you might as well just write it your damn selves. Because here's the thing, if you get 1,000 first lines that are trying to be artistic and you pick one, well, then that suggests you have the taste to identify it, which means you should have written it. You could have written it, right? Like, I don't know how we close that loop.
Right. Like, is this going to shoot out? It was a cold, bright day in April.
I just don't see how it would. Or it could, but it'd be one of 10,000 possibilities that you even yourself would have to evaluate to be the right thing.
Right. Right. And to decide.
And if you didn't know that already, or you weren't ready to create that yourselves, how would you know to select that one?
Right.
Yeah, because then it could have been a clear, bright day in April, and the clocks were striking 14. That's meaningfully different. I mean, I don't know. It's like...
Or, right, my mother is a fish.
I don't know how you get from here to there.
And out of... Yeah. And even those lines in themselves are... I mean, we're talking about...
Well, but just... yeah, sure, but why not? But that's how you see what the golf is, right?
But those... Right. And those lines are remarkable, but not just because they are great lines. It's because they are in the context of great works. And even if an AI could spit out 1, 2, 4 was spiteful, or they shoot the white girl first, or my mother is a fish, it would have to be able to spit out, you know, 100,000 other words that are in combinations that are just as creative and interesting and that make sense in context around each other to produce an edifying, enriching experience of art in some way. That even if you're reading what we would consider to be like a mid book or like what might be considered lowbrow or even formulaic genre fiction of some kind, you are trying to have some kind of experience. And it seems like the technology can't currently create something that gets you there, that gets you an experience of something meaningful, which I'm glad for. I'm with you. Like, I hope that one of the things that we learn from this is that there are things that humans can do. Technology
would you like to hear 4 sentences of it? Why don't we do this real quick? Yeah.
I think I have to.
Thomas Jones stood in the heart of his laboratory, bathed in the cold fluorescent light that hummed above. It was a sterile space devoid of personal touches, save for the collection of quantum field theory books occupying a corner shelf, a testament to his unwavering dedication. Thomas had published 10 groundbreaking papers on the subject, unraveling mysteries that had confounded the scientific community for decades. He spent 12 hours a day in his room, sometimes more, fueled by the insatiable desire to understand the universe. Like, if you don't get it, I don't know what to tell you. Are there people that look at that and like, holy crap, Philip K. Dick, I'm coming for the crown.
Take my money.
Anyway, I don't know. So there's that.
Maybe.
Pseudo right. Link in the show notes. Not sure what else to say.
Fascinating.
All right, now we're on to the regular news for 9 minutes. Of the rest of this episode this time. Where do you want to go? Anything you want to hit specifically before we wrap it up?
I got two that I think we want to hit, at least to refer folks to the full stories. This is the first kind of story like this that I've seen in the years, the almost 12 years that we have been doing what we're doing. Penn America and Penguin Random House have joined together to sue a Florida school district over what they are calling unconstitutional book bans. This is what Penn America does. They exist to, you know, protect freedom of speech and literary art. But I've never seen a publisher be involved in this kind of legal action against any entity that's trying to restrict other individuals' access to the thing that business produces. Really interesting. They are, you know, they're taking the angle that, which is correct, because the people trying to ban the books are saying it out loud, that the books being targeted for bans are disproportionately by non-white and LGBTQ authors and about themes that relate to, that relate to race and the LGBTQ community. So these challenges are openly discriminatory, and the restriction and removal of these disproportionately targeted books by or about people of color and or LGBTQ people prescribe an orthodoxy of opinion that violates the First and 14th Amendments. That is the argument that they're going to take. They then say that the county in Florida is called Escambia County. Seeks to bar books that critics view as too, quote, woke. In the 70s, schools sought to bar Slaughterhouse-Five and books edited by Langston Hughes. Tomorrow, this is the thing I think is really smart, yeah. It could be books about Christianity, the country's founders, or war heroes. All of these removals run afoul of the First Amendment, which is rightly disinterested in the cause du jour. I don't know nearly enough about constitutional law to guess about how this case will go. I assume that PEN America and PRH have good attorneys who know how to put together the strongest possible argument for this. I am very encouraged to see it rise to this level and to see a major player in the world of books and reading, the biggest publisher in the United States, take action like this, get involved in a heated political debate and take a stand. I'm really glad to see
I was just going to say that. We haven't said that in a while. I'm so glad to see the cavalry come in. And maybe it could have happened earlier. I don't know. The wheels of justice and lawyers for multi-billion dollar conglomerates, you know, can turn awfully slow. Boy, it feels like it's about damn time, but I don't also want to be one of those people. So let's cheer them on.
Yeah. Yes. And then we, because we are the two people that we are, have to mention, I think, that Taika Waititi is apparently going to direct an adaptation of Clara and the Sun. And I am the, like, very confused, the confusedest of confused face emojis about this combination.
Yeah, we're on the same page about this. I like Taika Waititi's work. I also like Ishiguro's work. They do not seem like a hand-in-glove situation to Waititi's very paints with a broad canvas. If you've seen Thor, Love and Thunder, or Jojo Rabbit, they have an element of the silly and camp, even to some degree. And silly and campy, I think, may be the last two adjectives I would use to describe the work of one Kazuro Ishiguro. I guess it's going to be, does Taika Waititi have a curveball as well? We've seen him throw fastballs and sliders. Does he have a curveball in there as well? I'm cheering for it. Not who I would picked in my draft of directors to try out this one.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be nervous about it. But I was just saying yesterday in a different context how for the last couple of years I've been completely blown away by the discovery that Bill Hader could produce something like Barry, that this like really funny comedic actor has very like a big dark side and very serious dramatic acting chops. That was a talk about a curveball. And so maybe I'm just going to hold out hope and possibility here that Taika Waititi will have a similar, you know, maybe he contains multitudes. I really, really hope that he does. It's a wonderful book. It's my favorite book of the last several years. I think yours too. and maybe it's his. Maybe he loves it and has a way in. He's a creative, interesting, surprising artist. But not the headline I expected about a Clara and the Sun adaptation,
again,
certainly.
We are not adapters, though we like both movies and books and TV, and so we're fans. I'm not even sure I'd pick Clara the Sun as necessarily a wonderful candidate to be adapted. That first section where she's just looking around? Maybe it's like the beginning of WALL-E, where you're finding a robot that doesn't say anything, and it's all world building. And Waititi is a very talented person. It's just that we haven't seen him do this before, so you have to go in thinking, well, it's got to be something different than he's done, I think, to get the kind of adaptation that captures what I enjoy about the book. It could be something that's wonderful and is based on and doesn't harness the same power of Clara and the Sun. And, you know, I'm a big fan of just adapted, and it doesn't hurt the original book. What it hurts sometimes is getting the adaptation that's good or faithful or captures the spirit if you don't do it well. But
I was thinking about how you can do a like inspired by adaptation, which Station Eleven was a little closer. The Watchmen adaptation a few years ago changed a lot of things, introduced a lot of different variables, dropped stuff from the book, brought in new like political variables, new pieces of history, and new modern hooks for an audience, and really felt like an inspired by the end of The Leftovers. It was definitely an inspired by, like, the second season of The Leftovers had nothing to do with the book. And maybe it's that, maybe he's going to build a story in this kind of world that Ishiguro
from the son's
has
point
imagined.
Of view.
But I think of his Waititi's work as like, maybe, or the machine, that big, what is she, I can't remember what she calls that big machine, the like road work situation. But Waititi is big and colorful and loud in a lot of ways. And Ishiguro is like quiet and restrained. And it's very difficult for me to imagine those two vibes together, but it's totally possible that someone who's as talented as Taika Waititi is, that maybe he's got that mode, and he's been looking for the way to express it. And Ishiguro is an executive producer on the project. I believe him to be pretty exacting about things. I'd be surprised if something horrible, like a horrible adaptation, came out. I don't think we're in a Demi Moore Scarlet Letter situation here. But I'll be very just interested and curious.
Yeah, and I think really your points about Watchmen and Station Eleven are good ones in this regard. Is like, I felt like tonally they were of a piece with the source material, even if they took some liberties with that. I mean, Watchmen turns out to be more of a direct sequel to the original Watchmen graphic novel. But tonally, it wasn't too far afield. So you got the cover to play around with. That's where the tone would be, novel to me to see from Waititi. But if it goes well, it could be really awesome and surprising and wonderful. So I'm glad to see something happening. I'll be watching it, but that was a surprise. I think we better end up there, Rebecca. We're running a little bit long. We got another thing to do. We got 10 years of podcasting to wrap up in an hour before my 1:30. So we got to cook. We got some work to do here. As always, you can find links to all the stories we talked about today at bookriot.com/listen. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Check out the Patreon, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. And go check out First Edition. You can hear me and Rebecca talk about the It Books of May. That episode came out in early of May. Our number one pick has not made much of an impact as I thought. We'll have to come back to that when we're getting ready to go to June. And one of my favorite interviews I've done, and I haven't done a whole lot, but it was really great to talk to Colette Asaini, a wonderful person. He has a wonderful story. The story of the book itself is fantastic. I hope to do more of these kinds of bookographies. If you have an idea for a book that would be especially well-suited, Da Vinci Code, to a bookography, I'm always open to ideas as well. Rebecca, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.